The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories. From World War II,
this, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War,
to the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
I'm Greg Karembas. I'm joined by Clint Romachet, the Medal of Honor winner due to his extraordinary service to this country in Afghanistan. We'll be talking about that as well as his other service to our nation. Your family has a great legacy of service to the United States. So before you joined the Army in the late 90s, you already knew what service was about. Tell us a little bit about your family's legacy.
You know, we had almost three generations of men in my family that served, starting with my grandfather in World War II. Then moving to my dad, who had done two tours in Vietnam, and then both my oldest brothers, my oldest went into the Army, and my second oldest went into the Marines. So growing up, you know, we were always kind of surrounded by military service, even though not a whole lot got talked about, especially between my father and my grandfather. But what did get talked about and what really stuck was that commitment to service, to serve one nation, you know. Do it more than just for yourself. This is the greatest country in the world, so that's what they were doing it for. And to listen to their stories of, you know, it wasn't these gory bloodbaths of battle, but it was the friendships they made, the lifelong commitments to other men that they'd serve with in their platoons and unit. My grandfather, actually, he joined when he was 17 due to the fact that his oldest brother actually got drafted originally for World War II. But his oldest brother was the only one that was old enough to do anything legal on the ranch. So Granddad kind of swapped identities back then and took his place. And originally came in as a cavalryman to train horses because Granddad used to ride rodeo back in Northern California. But unfortunately, as World War II kicked off, the Army made that transition from horses and cavalry to armor. So Granddad ended up being a combat engineer going into the war, landed on D-Day just 2 days after the invasion and followed Patton all the way through. And Dad, like I said, had done two tours in Nam and, you know, listening to stories of my oldest brother. In fact, I flew out to New York when he got out of the Army out of Fort Drum. And I got to see what a platoon was like right as he was transitioning out of the Army and the camaraderie with him and his buddies. You know, it was just something that's, you know, that friendship, that teamwork, and that commitment to something more than yourself, you know, I was sold.
So you were commissioned, I believe, in 1999, is that correct?
Coming out of high school, I probably wasn't the best student, so I kind of knew college wasn't going to be an option for me right away. I was very much a hands-on type of learner, so to sit there and read books, you know, just wasn't my style. So as soon as I graduated, I asked my father, you know, I'm going to join the Army. And Dad, being from Vietnam, he said, well, look, you're 17, I'm not going to sign for you. You're going to turn 18. If you still want to do it, you can do it on your own as a man. But he's like, right now, you know, it's 1999 at this time, and right now the nation really isn't at war. We're kind of in a peacetime status. He's like, but there'll come a day that your nation's going to call on you. You stay in long enough, your nation's going to call, and you're going to go over and you're going to see things that you'll never forget. So make sure before you sign, you understand this, and go on there with your eyes open. So, day after my 18th birthday, I signed up, shipped off a few weeks later to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and you know, the rest was kind of history from there. What was supposed to be a just quick 3-year enlistment turned into almost 12 by the time I got out.
Fort Knox. That what division? What unit were you in?
For Fort Knox, I was in Foxtrot 181 for basic training. It was back then, before Fort Benning took over the armor school, that's where all the armor guys went. Like I said, initially when Dad was talking to me, the one other piece of advice he gave me, he's like, whatever you do, don't go infantry. I was infantry. Go get a real job. You know, go do something that you can have when you get out of the service. You know, be a mechanic, be an X-ray tech, be anything but infantry. So when I signed up, I decided to go as a M1A1 Abrams tanker. I came back and told Dad, I was like, well, I didn't go infantry, but I want armor. I'm going to be a tanker. And he, of course, laughed at me. He's like, I told you not to do that. And I was like, no, Dad, you said don't go infantry. And he's like, yeah, but now you're on a tank. You're the biggest target on the battlefield. So, you know, going to small town, you know, Northern California to Fort Knox, Kentucky was, you know, a huge kind of, I wouldn't call it a culture shock, but growing up in the high desert of a town of about 100 people to all of a sudden being in a basic training unit of 100 people, you know, was an interesting transition in life. First duty station was Germany, and while I was there, when September 11th happened, my unit was out in the field in Grafenwehr training, doing maneuvers. We got a call across the radio from the squadron commander saying everyone needs to assemble here at the assembly point. And we form up, and Colonel comes out, and he's, today is the day that the rest of your life is going to change. He's like, we're not quite sure what has happened, but we do know there was a terrorist attack on the U.S. They flew planes into the World Trade Center. And from this day forward, your military experience is going to change. We pushed out to the gates. We locked down our post that we're at. And shortly thereafter, Afghanistan kicked off. But being heavy armor, we also knew Afghanistan wasn't quite a tank battle. It was going to be more infantry and more air assault assets than anything. We kind of knew we're kind of in a holding pattern. But then we started doing train-ups. We were actually the first, my division was one of the first divisions to do training in Czechoslovakia since World War II, because our mission was going to be, if we did go into Iraq, we're going to push south through Turkey. I started doing the train-up, and I'd re-enlisted, and lucky enough, somehow got the wonderful orders to go to Korea. So as I left Germany in transition to go to Korea, that's when the ground war kicked off in Iraq. And I tried to do every Weasley thing in the book to get my orders deleted, going to Korea and try to get back on with my unit back in Germany. But things being what they are in the military, I still got shipped out, and I stayed in Korea for almost 15 months when we'd gotten orders that they were going to send a brigade from Korea to Iraq, which was the first time that a already deployed unit redeployed to another theater of combat.
Do you believe that your push helped with that?
No, I don't think the complaining of a lowly E5 was going to do much in the wide world of a military rank. The time I was in Korea, though, I ended up being the squadron commander's gunner on his tank. And about 4 months before we got orders, I'd received word from a buddy back in Germany that my unit back there had deployed, and one of the great NCOs I always looked up to in Germany, he was Sergeant Gariantes. He was the guy that, when I first came in the military, he was the NCO you wanted to be. He was professional. He was on top of his game, and he understood what great leadership is, and he taught me as a young private that a great leader is someone who can change his mentality and his style to each individual soldier. It's not a leader that sits there and expects 25 guys or 40 guys from a platoon to each change their perspective to agree with you, but a good leader will change to each one of those. That carried with me my entire military career, but I'd find out that he had been shot and killed in Iraq. So when we'd gotten word that they were deploying units out of Korea, I had to ask my squadron commander, since I kind of had a direct line to him, hey, sir, I want to volunteer and go. And they were only taking two troops out of our squadron, our tank squadron, and attaching them with 2nd Infantry going. So he said, okay, I'll see what I can do, but you might want to call your wife and ask for permission first. So I gave it about 2 days before I went back into his office and talked to him and said, hey, sir, I'd called her. She understands. And he's like, well, are you sure? You know, you can, you've got a follow-on assignment to Fort Irwin. You literally could do the rest of your time here, go to Fort Irwin, serve out your contract, and never see a day of combat. And I said, well, it's not fair. I can't spend this much time in the Army and have buddies that have gone over there and me not, you know, serve. So he said, all right, well, as long as your wife says it's okay. Well, a couple days after that, I actually called my wife and I told her, well, I got orders, I have to go. And I didn't really give her that story until after I got back from that deployment, what had really conspired. You know, it was interesting to get pulled and go there with a unit to see combat for the first time and to understand that, you know, it doesn't really matter what the politics are when you're overseas. You do it for your battle buddies to your left and right. And you're doing it not because you hate the guy in front of you, but you do it because you love what's behind you.
When did you go to Iraq, and what areas did you see action there?
The first time I went to Iraq was 2004. We were attached with the 1st of the 506, and we were just right in between Ramadi and Fallujah, a little camp called Habaniya. Our main purpose there was to keep MSR, or Route Michigan, open for logistic supplies coming back and forth. And we pushed in to help support the retake of Fallujah back in 2004 with the Marines. Got back from that deployment, got stationed at Fort Carson. At that time, Uncle Sam came up to me and told me that I was no longer going to be on a tank, but I was going to be reclassed to a cavalryman, which deep down inside, having the lineage of my grandfather and horses, and you know, it was something I really, you know, was excited about getting. Like I said, voluntold. I would have volunteered on my own, but you know, it was great to make that transition. So I went to reclass school, learned how to, you know, be the light fighter, walking around, doing patrols, doing recon. So for my second deployment to Iraq, we started off in a place called Salman Pak, about 30 kilometers south of Baghdad. And on that deployment in 2006 to 2008 is when the surge was going on, so we got extended there for 15 months. And as the surge was going on, we started consolidating closer to Baghdad. By the end of it, we'd pushed up, and we were just outside of Sadr City by the time we'd redeployed back to the States from that deployment.
Congressional Medal of Honor recipient Clint Romache. When we come back, we'll learn about his deployment to Afghanistan and service there that ultimately led to the highest honor the military gives.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. I'm joined by Clint Romache, recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. In the previous segment, we learned about his family's lineage through the military and his service from 1999 through 2008 in terms of his deployments to Germany, Korea, and two tours in Iraq. From the time you got back there in 2006 to the time you left in 2008, how much of a difference had you seen in the situation in Iraq?
You know, it was a big change. You know, the first time over there, it was very much still a pretty hard-nosed ground fight. Like I said, going into Fallujah, you know, there was the enemy there willing to face you. Coming back the second time during the surge and stuff, it was more, you know, let's win the hearts and minds. Let's control the major population areas. Let's get the locals to kind of pick up their part of the task and take over, you know, because you can't just go in there and wreck everything and then expect them to pick up the next day. So, you know, the mentalities were almost 180 degrees.
So this leads us to the point where ultimately you got different orders, and that meant going to Afghanistan.
You know, we got, like I said, we got back from Iraq the second time. We knew turnaround was going to be pretty quick. But kind of got excited, though, to find out we were going to Afghanistan on our next hitch. You know, I'd been to Iraq twice, so it was kind of like, let's get the whole ticket punched and see both ends of the spectrum. And we really lucked out with my unit because Sergeant Kirk had just been over in that part of Afghanistan literally less than a year before, and he came to my platoon as one of my team leaders. So to have Sergeant Kirk, you know, right in our back pocket to let us know, to train as a small unit, to say, look, here's what we're going to face. We're going to face mountains that are steeper than anything you've seen. You know, we need to concentrate on the PT. We need to concentrate on, you know, weapons qual, getting guys taught how to fire angle fire. You know, we got to practice this stuff. We got to be on top of it. You got to get guys that can carry this weight up and down the mountains. So it gave us a leg up, especially coming from Fort Carson, where we were at, you know, almost 6,500 feet above sea level, to get our guys in shape, to get some really good firsthand experience and knowledge ingrained in the platoon. And I hate to say it, you can do all the training in the world, and there's a lot of great Army training out there, but from three deployments, I learned the best training you get is the first 30 days in country. But to have a veteran that had already been there and kind of done that, to get his little, you know, add-ons and tweaking it just to be a little bit tighter and a little bit finer, you know, gave our unit an excellent heads up on basically the competition.
When you got there, what were your orders?
You know, we got into country, and the main push at the time was, you know, the elections were coming back up. We were the only basically American forces in that part of Nuristan, the only kind of pulse on what was going on up there. So originally getting there, it was kind of a torn between, do we keep the outpost going? Do we tear it down? You know, we got the elections coming. Do we need to hold out for that? Do we just need to cut sling load? And my squadron commander and my brigade commander, Colonel George and Colonel Brown, I mean, those men, you know, fought tooth and nail because they understood that Kop Keating was not the most tactically sound spot to defend. And those two men, I mean, they put their whole careers on the line to get us either moved up to Fritchie or established a better tactical position to hold out from. But as the course of things started running through, it was, you know, at times it felt like we were really just there to, you know, kind of check a block.
How soon after that did you get to Kamdash?
We, like I said, we got into country and shipped right up to Kop Keating within the first week about being in country. It was a pretty quick turnaround for us. Normally, you kind of hold over in one of the spots like ABAD or Navstar in Iraq. But no, we pushed up, me and my platoon leader, my platoon sergeant, we pushed up to Kop Keating almost within that first week to start doing link up and start with the relief in place progress with the unit we're replacing. And I remember the first time getting there, you know, the only way to access the outpost was by helicopter. The road that had originally been up there that opened back in, I believe, 2006 had now been so impassable to drive military vehicles on, you just couldn't do it. So we got in there that night, couldn't see anything, had no real idea. You know, we'd seen the slides, we'd gotten the briefs, gotten firsthand accounts from Sergeant Kirk and stuff, but it wasn't until that next morning I woke up and I went outside in the light for the first time, and you just look up and it's mountains all around you, 360 degrees. You're just looking straight up, and I remember thinking to myself, it's like, wow, I'm going to have some massive neck muscles because all you can do is just look up. You can't look any farther down than here. And it was, at first, it was, you know, who would do this to soldiers? Who would pick this spot? But that's also one of the great things about military service and our veterans is you can give them kind of the hairiest and kind of crappiest situations, and these men and women will just take it with every ounce of true grit and will make the absolute most of a bad situation.
Clint, we're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll learn all about the battle that changed your life forever. We'll be right back.
Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles and follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast. Radio America and the American Veterans Center. This is Veterans Chronicles.
I'm joined today by Clint Romesche, recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And Clint, when we left off on our last segment, we had pretty much set the stage for the Battle of Kamdesh. And the way that I've read about it is that you guys were simply sleeping in an area that ultimately the enemy had surrounded pretty much on every side, and they were very well armed. So it was, to say the least, the rudest wake-up call you've probably ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, we were there for about 3 months before the attack happened. And, you know, it was every day. Our intel guys would come up and tell us, look, we're getting intel that's saying they're going to hit us with 300 to 500 fighters. And the unit that we replaced gave us the same reports. So in a way, you know, you keep hearing this thing every day, and it's like, you know what, it's almost like crying wolf. But up to that point, though, I'd sit out there and, you know, at night with my team leaders, Sergeant Larson and Sergeant Gallegos, Sergeant Kirk, Sergeant Hart, and even my platoon leader would chime in every so often. It would allow them to come into the NCO circle every so often. But we would talk about, you know, if we were to attack us, how would we do it, you know? And October 3rd, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, bright and early, I'd just gotten off guard a few hours before, so I was still racked out. When the rounds came in, you just knew this wasn't, you know, the everyday normal wake-up call attack. We were getting shot at it on average about once a day. But that morning when it came in, it was just like, this is something more. This is the real deal, guys. And looking at it, you know, in hindsight, the way they hit us is exactly the game plan we came up with ourselves. And so in preparation for that, we tried to do little things to improve our situation, stashing ammo in certain areas, readjusting battle positions and times of guard. But, you know, when it first came in, I remember, like I said, getting woke up, and I threw my kit on. I turned my radio on. My platoon at the time was the perimeter security. Blue platoon was tasked during a troops in contact or a firefight. Their mission was to help resupply whatever unit was out on a perimeter with ammunition and reinforce battle positions. So as I'm sitting there trying to get a situation report from my guys on the perimeter, I mean, every report coming in is taking overwhelming fire that's precise, that is, you know, just pinning them down. And they're trying to return fire, and most of the weapon systems went into a what's known as a cyclic rate of fire. As fast as they could fire those 50 cals and 240s and Mark 19s, they were trying to pour it back at the enemy. But the enemy had great elevated positions. They had great support by fire set in, where they could suppress with one and maneuver around to get a better angle on our defensive positions. And right away we knew that unless we could get indirect fire support or close air support, that it was going to be a long day. And the enemy was smart. They instantly hit our mortars right off the bat, so we couldn't get our mortars up and running. OP Fritchie was on the hill just to the south of us that could normally support us, but they attacked them at the same time, tying up their indirect fires. And where we were positioned from our main forward operating base, Bostic, we were right on the gun line for the 155s. We were right at max range, so we could only really use them to the south of our position. And we had close air support with the Apache gunships coming out of ABAD, but that took about 45 minutes or so. But the enemy was smart. They'd put Dushka anti-aircraft guns up on the mountains and actually hit one of the aircraft that came in for the first run and disabled his hydraulics, which in hindsight was a good thing because he was able to, they did a quick gun run for us and turned around and went back, and the Apache pilot jumped right out of his aircraft as they were bringing a new one, a fresh one up for him, and he went in to talk to our squadron commander and said, hey, those boys need everything in theater because they are in a bad way. Back there, as I was, like I said, trying to get the sit rep, trying to figure out what's going on, started trying to maneuver guys around to get them out of, you know, because there wasn't too many places to be in a defensive position without being absolutely exposed. What we knew was, as time went on, until we could get that air support back, we had to hold out. And I kept calling Sergeant Gallegos to try and figure out what we could do with them. And Blue Platoon had tried to push out and resupply them with ammo, but it was almost to no avail. A couple of guys had made it out there and was able to give them some, but we knew at this point we were in such a bad way. Shortly thereafter, that's when we'd found out that the front gate had been hit and that Sergeant Kirk had gone down. You know, it's never easy to hear that come across the radio, but we understood we still had a fight on our hands. So I went into the talk to my platoon leader, who was the on-the-scene commander that day, and tried to figure out what our next move was, tried to figure out when our air assets could be there. And, you know, there was just everything coming in at once. And I'd walked back out to go check on Kirk at the aid station. And as I was in there, I gave the thumbs up or down to Doc Cordova, and he gave me the thumbs down. And it was a hard loss, but, you know, we still had a fight. And Copus, Specialist Copus, was on a gun position just outside the aid station. And I'd pulled his local security off him because there was no place for those guys to be without getting shot. There just wasn't cover there. So he was out there by himself, and he'd called me up saying that he'd had a sniper on his six that was just pinning him down. So as I was leaving the aid station, I noticed there was an Afghan National Army soldier in there that was wounded pretty badly, but he had a Dragunov sniper rifle. So I figured, why not upgrade a weapon system? So I kind of threw my M4 over my shoulder and slung it and grabbed up the sniper rifle, and I went out to Copus and asked him how he was doing. His rounds were just bouncing off his turret. He was, you know, sitting there like a true champ. Just, you know, he was taking rounds, but he was the only gun position at that time still in the fight. So he told me, you know, I got this sniper that keeps popping at me every time I try and get up and traverse. Can you help me? So I started playing peekaboo back and forth, and after a few exchanges back and forth, we quieted him down, and Copus was able to get back up on the gun and start doing his job, laying it down more on the enemy. After that, I'd ran back to the barracks, try to get a feel for what else was going on, and Gallegos kept calling up that they were out of ammo, that, you know, they were sitting there stuck, they couldn't move. So I went back to the barracks, and I seen Specialist Gregory sitting in there, and he had a 240 with him, or a Mark 48 light machine gun. I told Gregory, hey, grab what we had left of the ammo and come follow me. Grabbed the machine gun from him, and we snuck around. Somehow made it up to a generator where we could look out to the west where Gallegos' position was. Threw the machine gun up on this generator to use it as basically a bunker, and called up Gallegos and was like, hey, I'm going to try and throw some rounds down your way to keep their heads down. If you can make it back, you know, come back. Me and Gregory got you guys. And Gallegos said, well, you can try, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff out here. So we started dumping rounds at the enemy, and said there were just so many targets up on the mountain. I mean, it just didn't matter how fast you were firing or how quick you could move from one to the next. You know, there's just too many, and kept trying to call him up and let him know, hey, I'm trying to suppress. If you can move, go. Gallegos kept calling back saying, well, brother, you just ain't got enough firepower with that one machine gun. I made the mistake of, you know, one thing I always tried to teach my soldiers is, you know, don't put the blinders on. Always keep your head on the swivel. Well, the enemy was able to outflank me to the right, me and Gregory, and they came through the front gate and fired an RPG into the generator we were sitting on. Took it to the right side, and it blew me on Gregory, who's to my left. Kind of shook the dirt off and picked up Gregory, checked him out real quick to make sure he was all right. Said, well, make it back to the barracks, I'll cover you. I took the last belt of ammo, loaded it up, started returning fire in the direction. At the same time, I'm on the radio with Gallegos, and I told him, I'm sorry, brother, I don't have any ammo left, and I just got hit. I can't cover any more. And he said, oh, we'll just hang out here. You can get to us when you can. We'll just hang out. I broke contact and was able to make it back. Came back, and that's when Sergeant Rasmussen came up to me, and he's like, hey, you're hit. I looked down, and I was like, what are you talking about? And I looked at my arm, and I had a piece of shrapnel in my arm. I was kind of bleeding, and Raz grabbed my dressing out of my pouch and wrapped it up, and I was like, well, I can still talk, I can walk, I can shoot, I can move, I'm good to go. Went back into the talk and gave the sit rep to Lieutenant Bunderman that, you know, I'd try to help Gallegos and then bust out, but until we get that indirect fire and that close air, we can't do much. And he said, well, we just got to hold on. At this point, we'd consolidated and collapsed in what we later ended up calling our Alamo position. And I walked back into the barracks to kind of get a feel for who we had left and who was still in the fight and what we could do at that point. And Sergeant Hart came up to me and he said, hey, Sergeant Ramos, I've been talking to Sergeant Stanley. We've found more 50 cal ammo. We want to sneak up to that other Humvee just on the south side. I think we can get to it. We'll load up that truck. We'll get the 50 up and rocking. We're going to push over and go grab Gallegos and them. And I remember kind of going back and forth with Hart for a bit, telling him, brother, I can't set anything to on your north side to protect your northern flank. I just got blown off the generator up there. It's not a good idea. But, you know, that was Hart, though. You weren't going to tell him no. So I told him, you know, go ahead and do it. And I knew at that point that'd be the last I'd see of him. And he took off, and they made it out to that Humvee, and they got that 50 cal going, and they pushed it over there. And the entire time, Gallegos was calling up Hart, saying, "Brother, don't come here. This is the death trap." But he was able to make it just up to him. Started getting that 50 gun and 50 cal in position, and started rocking it. Unfortunately, the area he had to go up to, there was a newly constructed building they were working on. Part of the wall had collapsed, and the Humvee had gotten high-centered and stuck, and they were unable to move at that point. A short while later, a call came across the radio from Hart. It said, hey, they got RPG pointed right at me, and that was the last we heard from them. At that point, you know, it's just one of those... You know, everything seems to be going sideways, but we're not out of the fight yet. We still got guys up and kicking. We got to do something about it. So I ran back to the talk, seen my lieutenant. I told him, hey, sir, we're all basically out of ammo. We need to get the ammo supply point. They're in the wire. We don't know what's going on with Gallegos and Hart and them. Let's counterattack. Kind of gave him a quick scheme of maneuvers of how I planned on doing it, and he's like, sure, go ahead. So I walked back into the barracks and I asked for volunteers. Five guys stood up and said, we'll follow you anywhere, Sergeant Rowe. And Raz and Delaney and Danley, Sergeant Miller, and Jones. And in hindsight, you know, looking back, it's like, who would come in there and ask to counterattack as you're getting overran? That's kind of a silly thing to do. But to have those five guys just stand there and say, we'll follow you anywhere, in the midst of all that it's indescribable how that feels. And just to see the look on their face, to just see that true determination of, we're American soldiers, we're not going to be beat. We're not going to give up. We're not going to quit. We're not going to quit until there's nothing left in the tank. And we pushed out, made our first bound, and were able to get to the ammo supply point. Pushed the enemy off that, started kicking ammo back to the rest of the guys in the Alamo position to refit them. Realized that the next move was we got to go to the front gate. We got to shut that off so the enemy can't just roll in. We just got to go. We got to do it. We made our second bound, got up there, somehow made it up there unscathed. And was able to shut the front gate on them, pushed them out. By then, we'd finally gotten some good close air support in. Indirect fire started coming. And we realized, all right, tide's kind of turning. But at this point, I also figured that we'd lost contact with, like I said, Hart and Sergeant Gallegos and them. We really kind of figured that there was no one left up there. And the only thing that was keeping us going was we were going to bring everyone home one way or another, because the enemy had been known for taking soldiers. but I don't know if it was 10 minutes or 2 hours. Mutterman called me on the radio and said, "You won't believe this, but Sergeant Larson, Carter, and Mace are still alive. If you can push out a little farther and set a support by fire, I'll bring in close air support. We'll cover their move. Mace is very badly wounded, but Larson, Sergeant Larson and Carter think they can grab him and bring him back to the aid station." So we pushed out, started suppressing the enemy off to the north and the west. Larson and Carter grabbed Mace, ran by us. We pushed back into our defensive perimeter of the Shura building, the front gate there. A few minutes later, Larson called me up and said, "Hey, I've just been checked out by the medics. They said I'm good enough to go. What do you need on the way out?" I told him, "Well, grab the Dr. Pepper and the cigarettes and meet me out here." A few minutes later, Larson shows up, spry as a chicken, you know. Got a 12-pack of Dr. Peppers and a pack of Camel Lights and cracked open a warm, just almost syrupy Dr. Pepper and chugged it down and smoked a quick smoke and realized that we still had guys out there, though. And we were really concerned that the enemy had enough time to be in our wire, that we need to find everyone.
Veterans Chronicles. A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. We're with Medal of Honor recipient Clint Romachet, who has just been telling us the gripping story of the Battle of Camp Dash and the effort now to rescue folks they were surprised to find still alive up in the mountains. Go ahead and continue.
Like I said, Larson had joined me. And Larson had the intel where he'd seen some of our fallen heroes. But we didn't have an account of two of them. We didn't quite know where Hart was, and we didn't know where... my big concern was we were missing two. So I ran back, linked up with my platoon leader again. I told him, "Hey, sir, we need to go find him." And we kind of went back and forth because Lieutenant Bunderman was on top of his game, and he realized that we were stretching pretty thin. Had to go out and get Hart, had to get Martin. It was going to be a risky maneuver. But I had kind of persuaded my way into letting him know that that's what we were going to do. So I went back, got a few more volunteers. We pushed back out to the gate and came up with a plan that we'd go get the guys where Larson had last seen them, and then we'd start a search pattern if we could. We made our first bound out, got established, made our second push, got almost up to where Gallegos' position originally was. And on the way there, we'd found Martin up under the laundry trailer. Casualty recovery team was able to grab him and bring him back. Pushed a little farther and was soon able to find Gallegos. The casualty recovery team was able to push up again and grab him up. But at that point, we were stretched too thin. I finally had gotten communication back with Sergeant Breeding, our mortar platoon sergeant, who had been isolated up at the mortar pit with him and Rodriguez and we're... Private Thompson, was the first casualty that day, was still at. And I called up Breeding to let him know that the original plan was I was going to try and make it all the way up there to them, grab them, and bring them back. But we just couldn't push any farther. We didn't have the coverage. Five guys, you know, we just couldn't cover all that ground, couldn't hold it. And we'd recovered, like I said, everybody at that point besides Hart. So we came back, peeled back into a defensive position, and we'd gotten word from Bunderman that the QRF had landed up on OP Fritchie and would probably be down in a few hours, and the orders were to hold what we got, wait for the QRF to come in and reinforce us. I'd called them back and let them know who we were able to get, and Hart was the only one still missing. I just couldn't search... a big enough pattern with the guys we had. And he said, "Well, just cover what you got. we'll wait for the reinforcements. Just as it was getting dark, quick reaction force came off the mountain, pushed through our wire and made link up with them. Kind of give them the layout of the area. We got word that the medevac was coming in for Mace, that we could get Mace out of there. He was still hanging on, but pretty bad shape. So I volunteered, took my team, and we pushed out to the LZ because our landing zone for the helicopter was actually outside our wire. So we had to go launch out and secure that. But I just kept thinking to myself that Hart was gone. We pushed out, secured the LZ. Bird was coming in. We were able to get Mace on it. Just as we were about to push in the wire, Chosen Company, who reinforced us, called us up and let us know that they'd found Hart, that he was only about 25 or 30 meters from our last position we'd finally gotten to. But we knew that we'd finally had everyone. Everyone was going home. And that even though we'd lost, you know, four guys directly from my platoon, we didn't get beat that day. We stood up against very well-trained and very dedicated enemy fighters. And they hit us with 300-plus guys. And us, 52, stood there and pushed them off and took back what they had tried to take from us for only a few short hours.
Clint, it's an honor to meet you, sir. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your service. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
I'm joined by Congressional Medal of Honor recipient Clint Romache. I'm Greg Corumbus. This has been Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles and follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.